Hi there, it's Little Jimmy Brownie here again with another Outrigged Capercast. Thanks for coming. I'm continuing with that next last chapter, audio updates for chapter 5 of my book, Among the Multihulls. Now, I realize that anyone who has read the book has heard these stories before, but I've been told that people would rather hear them than read them. And I love to tell them because they were such a crucial part of my early multi-hull involvement. So I'll try to take you to a place where we were sailing along in a gentle tropic sea, just ghosting in a shallow fog. It seemed like the masthead must have been out in the moonlight. And we really didn't know where we were, me and Russell Miller. Russ was my late great friend from boyhood. One of the finest roustabout dudes that I've ever known. He was asleep up in Juana's bow, and I was at the helm when I heard surf. The conditions were so mild that I could clearly hear a gentle swell breaking on rocks. And going by a dead reckoning on the chart, I figured we must be close to one of the Tres Marias Islands. The little breakers were off to the left, so I slid in a little bit closer and then began to hear other breakers off to the right. We're in a moonlit glowing fog now. So I went in a little closer, and I began to hear the same swell but sliding up and down a beach. Now for sure, if the conditions hadn't been so quiet, I wouldn't have gone anywhere near this island. But we crept in until I could hear surf on the rocks both sides and sliding up and down a beach in front. Dropped the anchor. Sailed right over it, jerked on it as hard as we could, got the sails down, and went to bed. On a night like that, I often drink too much water before going to bed, so I'll have to get up and take a peek at how things are going in the middle of the night. It's an old Indian trick. Then you drink too much water again, so you'll be sure to be up, you know, long about daylight. And, oh, man, there we were anchored right in the middle of a spectacular cove. It was one of the most marvelous approaches and anchorages that I've ever experienced. Absolutely nobody around. And there's pictures of that cove in the chapter-by-chapter videos for Chapter 5. Now, here's how we got there. We left off last time with Joanna and I returning to Sausalito, really down and out and dependent on the mercy of our friends. But this was a very different time in history. In one day of hunting, I was able to find myself a job at a marina doing varnish jobs on wooden power boats. Of course, I also ended up sanding boat bottoms. And I told my employer that I had built my own trimaran and sailed it to Mexico, and he had heard about it. And with that, he gave me a 1 week's advance on my paycheck. Never happened today. And with that, I was able to buy a really sick old Chevrolet coupe for $50 and rent for me and Joanna a little fold-up bed apartment in Mill Valley. Pretty soon, Joanna had the baby, and I found myself to be a family man. It was quite an adjustment for both of us, because we'd been off on this big-deal adventure kick. And poor little Stephen had colic, so we went through the whole trip of sleepless nights and dealing with non-disposable diapers. But the upshot was that after about 4 months of that, we had saved enough money for me to go back to Mexico and retrieve the boat. So I contacted my old friend Russell Miller. It turned out that he had just returned from a trip hitchhiking around the world. Yeah, he was one of those guys. He was visiting his parents in New York. And of course, they were hopeful that he had sown enough wild oats and would settle down and get a job. But no, I'm going to go off to Mexico with Jim in a little sailboat. So we were able to fly to La Paz and catch a ride on an old truck and got down there to Cape San Lucas, retrieved the boat out of the cannery. Again, the Mexicans helped us carry it in pieces to the beach, where we put it together, cleaned it up, and shoved off. So after a couple of days of sailing across the Gulf of Baja California, we came upon the Tres Marias Islands in the middle of the moonlit night, and now found ourselves in this cove. Yeah, we were headed south again, even though we wanted to go north. We had to get the boat to a shipping point, so we were trying to get down to Manzanillo, a Mexican seaport, another, 500 miles south of the tip of Baja. And that last day on our approach to Manzanillo, we had perhaps the greatest run we ever had in that boat. Big, blue, roly-poly, beautiful waves that were not breaking, at least not dangerously. And we went surfing into the little roadstead at Manzanillo at speeds, approaching 20 knots, I'm sure. And we hung around for a few days there trying to find some sort of ship going north. There was a banana boat anchored in the harbor. We went over, made friends with the captain. We were having breakfast with him one morning when he looked up and pointed and said, "Hey, look, there's a big tuna clipper. She looks loaded. I bet you she's going home to San Diego." Now, this was one of the most fortuitous things that ever could have happened. We took Juana over alongside the tuna clipper. Some of the crew came out, helped us tie up. I asked to speak to the captain. I told the crew we were trying to get back to the States. Somebody went, got the captain. In fact, he and I were walking around the corner of a deckhouse in opposite directions and sort of bumped into each other. He looked up and said, "Hey, boy, you going home? I am going home today. Cost me no more. You come or you don't come." Yeah. The whole crew was Portuguese, but the Mexican port authority insisted that we do not load aboard the tuna clipper in their harbor. They would have had to make up a manifest and all that stuff. And so we went outside. Both of us went out in the ocean, and they stuck out their big net boom and picked Juana right up, swung her around, put her in the tween decks on a big pile of net. And Miller and I spent 5 wonderful days motoring back up against the wind all the way to San Diego. It would have taken us months to sail the boat back against the wind that far. Didn't have that kind of time. Had to get back to work. Well, we rode the bus from San Diego back to Sausalito, bought a different old car, fixed up a trailer. Joanne and I loaded into that thing with the baby, drove to San Diego, hauled the boat out, cut the crossbeams off, took the thing apart, loaded it on its side on this trailer, and drove it back to San Francisco. Put her back together and had her there to play with while I was sanding boat bottoms. And while Stephen was growing out of his infancy. I think he was about 8 months old when we first took him sailing. Well, I got carried away on that little piece of the story. But by way of update, I don't think we could pull that off today. For one thing, it's just too darn hard for young people to get a job now. A job that was pretty rough, but still paid enough so that you could actually save money. And then the whole thing with the tuna clipper and all that, the Tres Marias Islands, we later learned, one of them is the site of a maximum security prison for Mexico, and those three little islands are now totally barred from yacht traffic. You can't go near them. But the one we landed on, there was nobody around. We didn't see a soul. And Russ and I really played Robinson Crusoe there for a couple of days. Had a wonderful time. Tried to catch an iguana. Miller pulled the tail off. We beached the boat and worked on the rudder. We'd had a failure in the lower rudder gudgeon on the way across the Gulf, and I had to reach over into the water to lash the rudder back onto the transom while we were underway. And so we beached the boat in order to make a better repair, and it lasted the rest of the trip. Of course, we had to jam a ketchup bottle into the lashings to tighten them up. And that kind of thing, the whole thing of being picked up and taken back to San Diego free, I don't think that kind of thing happens much anymore. I asked the captain of the clipper what I could do for him, and we were in San Diego, and I told him we were going to San Francisco and coming back, and he said, "Oh, you coming back from San Francisco, boy? Bring me some crab." Well, they don't really have Dungeness crabs in San Diego, so when we came back, we had the whole trunk full of ice and crab. Had a huge feast with the whole crew of the boat over to John Reese's home. There was one young Portuguese guy in the crew who did not have sufficient paperwork for him to be allowed ashore in the United States. So while we were up in San Fran getting the trailer ready, his immigration lawyer, a woman, offered to marry him, bring him into the States, then divorce him, turn him loose. How often does that happen today? Well, anyway, back in San Francisco, Arthur Piver arranged for me to write an article about our trip for, I can't remember what magazine. You know, I think it was called Motorboating. Later changed to Motorboating and Sailing. I don't think I have a copy of that article. I suppose it was published about in the middle of 1961. Gee, if anyone feels like doing research, boy, I'd really like to have a copy of that for our Outrig collection. This was before Cruising World magazine. It might have been Rudder magazine. Anyway, I wrote that article, and it was published with some of our photos, and geez, all of a sudden, I was not only a published author, I was an instant expert. We had done this thing on the lunatic fringe, and Piver was really selling some plans now. And I took an order to build a little frolic for the president of a large insurance company. All of a sudden, I had my own little boat shop. It was right down there in the heart of the old Sausalito shipyard. And it was about then that Piver started building his 30-footer for crossing the Atlantic, and later his 35-footer for crossing the Pacific. And what I'm here to say is that the backyard-built ocean cruising trimaran craze was on. You'll recall that the reason I built my first little Piver frolic was that I could do it for $200. And then the reason that I built my 24-foot Wanna was that I could do it for about $2,000. And the reason that literally thousands of others began to build their own boats was because they could be built inexpensively. Plywood, glue, and fiberglass. No cast ballast keel. No heavy weights to handle. And in the California climate, they could be built outside. You didn't have to have a big heated boat shop and all that stuff. All you needed was carpenters and painter's tools. And even if you'd never built so much as a birdhouse in your life, if you followed those plans, which a lot of people didn't, you could come up with something that was really a seafaring vessel. And I must admit that I'm quite disappointed that the whole phenomenon has developed into something that is so techy and so costly that it has pretty much driven the can-do, how-to common man right out of the picture. Now, it's not that plans for inexpensive owner-built multi-hulls are not still available. They are from many designers, and in my opinion, the real culmination of that particular quadrant of the multi-hull phenomenon, owner building, is not addressed better anywhere than by John Marple's series of Sea Clipper trimarans. If any of this blab of mine would induce a listener to contemplate building his own boat and hitting the big briny, there are lots of places to look for plans, but don't forget to go to SeaRunner.com and look at the Sea Clipper portfolio. After going through everything I've told you, and then going through everything that I'm going to tell you about Sea Runner trimarans coming up soon, we have finally distilled it down to something that is really very functional, very approachable, non-yachty, but I've always considered a cruising boat to be a highly specialized work boat, and that's what these Sea Clippers are. And I think it's really sad that there are very few people building boats like that these days, and it's because the world just doesn't work that way anymore. And I'll try to get around to talking about why I think it doesn't work that way anymore. But in the meantime, I'd rather talk about how Sea Runners happened and why. I guess it was sometime in the summer of 1961 that Joanna and I grew weary of the Sausalito houseboat scene. We were living in a groovy old barge called the Dixie Belle in an upstairs apartment when the guy downstairs died and there was a lot of pushing and shoving, so we decided to get out of there. And along came a new friend, interesting guy, Guido Turnison, who said, "Hey, we're living in Big Sur. Come down and have a look." Well, Guido fixed it up for us to not only find a place to live on the Ralph Newell Ranch way up on the mountain, but also Ralph Newell was looking for somebody to help him build on a new place. And so, heck, I had a place to, all of a sudden, I had a place to live and a job. Down there in Big Sur at a time when the place still had a real frontiersy feeling to it, which I think is pretty much gone today. Some of the descendants of the people that originally pioneered, you know, settled that area as a Spanish land grant were still around when we were there. It had some of that ambiance that is maybe best expressed by a few words in that song that almost became popular called The South Coast. I used to sing it, but I can't anymore. It's like, "My name is Juan Jano de Castro. My father was a Spanish grandee, but I won my wife in a card game. To hell with those lords cross the sea. The South Coast is a wild coast and a lonely. You may win in a game at alone, but the lion still rules the barranca, and a man there is always alone." God, that's awful. But yeah, since the days of colonial California, when the Spanish had a big mission at Monterey, the Big Sur area was known since then as the South Coast. And it was so rugged, so steep, the barrancas, the canyons cutting up into the mountains so sharply that the Mission Trail didn't try to come up the coast there, even though it had started all the way from Baja and stayed on the coast. When it got to the Big Sur area, it went inland up through the Central Valley of California. And the road along the Big Sur coast was cut in there by the CCC boys back in the Depression. It was definitely a make-work project, and when we got there, the road was paved, but it was made out of patches, two lanes rough and treacherous. But we came to love the area and the people. It was sort of like Key West or Cabo, you know, as far as you can go, Land's End, to get away from the rest of society. And I've told you all about, you know, living in Newell's barn and building boats up there on the mountain and down in the canyon and all that stuff. And we made particular friends with Don and Gretchen McQueen, and we began to build a boat together, a 40-foot Piver Design Victrus. Yeah, we built the first Piver Victrus down there in the Big Sur Valley. And while building it, I explained to Don that I thought we ought to change a little of this and a little of that. It's what so many Piver builders did, because the plans were relatively incomplete. In Piver's own words, he said they looked like they were drawn by some drunk. He was not a draftsman. That tended to encourage improvisation. And in my case, it was a good thing, at least for me. And Piver was away, you know, crossing the Atlantic or something. I was still helping his wife sell plans, and we sold a set of Piver plans to a guy named Chuck Folden. He was an aviator, a crop duster, and a fire bomber. He called it herding them airplanes around them rocks. Well, he picked up his plans from Mrs. Piver up in the Bay Area, and she told him to come and see us because we were building a boat something like it. Well, he came down and he saw the differences that I had decided to tinker with Piver plans, you know. And he said, "Oh, I want to do some of those for my boat." And the way it actually turned out was that Don McQueen convinced him that I ought to start from scratch and design him a whole new boat. And holy Jesus, I couldn't draw either. I had never even taken a course in mechanical drawing. But Don had, and Don showed me how to draw. So working together, we produced the plans for a 38-foot trimaran that I called Off Soundings. That's an old mariner's term that refers to sailing offshore far enough beyond the 100-fathom line, which was about as deep as soundings could be taken in those days, because you had to use a lead line of some kind to take a sounding. So if you were offshore beyond the 100-fathom line, you were off soundings, and now that meant you were at sea, brother. Anyway, Chuck Folden began to build that boat in Mexico. There's a long story there about that boat, which I'll skip over. But when Piper got back from England, I showed him these drawings. I was ready to offer them up. Let's put the plans for this thing in your stable, Art. What I was really striving for was to become partners with this guy. Unfortunately, Arthur felt that the trimaran was his sacred territory. He returned my plans to me. Our friendship ceased abruptly. I guess I'll never know whether he was threatened by the competition or whether he was doing what a good mentor must do for his protege, which is kick him out of the nest. And wouldn't you know, the next thing I knew, I was selling my own plans to backyard builders of trimarans. Or, well, patient listeners, I'm not sure if you can tell, but I'm having an absolute terrible time with my computer. This is a sob story that doesn't have anything to do with the other story I was trying to tell. But let me explain that I have to use a program called ZoomText, which is very efficient at magnifying the screen, has many features that I can use in order to kind of make up for my failing eyesight. Audacity has given me fits in the past, but it's doing just fine today. What's giving us the trouble is ZoomText, and ZoomText's ability to get along with Windows. I want to tell you about Joe Hudson's boat. My late friend Joe Hudson, who just died a month or two ago, he had a wonderful 23-foot Marples designed and built little racy little trimaran called Cyclone. And Joe's wife, Sherry, is now trying to dispose of that boat. It's located at Joe's place up on the mountain in Big Sur. But it's on a trailer. It's been stored undercover for years. And Joe's last project was to try to get that boat going again. And he and his Mexican sidekick, Fernando, have done a beautiful job of repainting her. The thing is in pristine condition. And I want to tell you that, Joe and I and our friends made 5 trips to Baja California. 2 of them were made in this boat, just me and Joe, and they were the finest trips to Baja that we ever enjoyed. The thing turned out to be a great cruising boat in that climate. But what it would probably be used for today is racing. It's a hot little number when it's not overloaded with cruising stuff. It would be a great boat for dashing around the buoys with the farriers and stuff. And also, I think where it really belongs is in the R2AK, that is this endurance race to Alaska. It would be a very good boat for either 1 or 2 people in the R2AK. I'm not sure yet what Sherry would sell it for. I do know that when Joe bought it from John Marples many years ago, he paid $10,000 for it, which was a steal. It's constant camber construction built by John Marples for himself. Now, I'm going to be putting together a description of the boat with some photos and so forth, and we're going to advertise it on the West Coast and hope we can find the right buyer for this thing. This is a really tremendous little boat. We want it used by someone who will really learn to love it. Yeah, I gotta let you know about a couple of very informative things that have been published by our longtime Sea Runner sailor, Mark Johnson. First of all, Mark has written a very definitive little book on how to anchor the cruising multi-hull. I've had a lot to say about anchoring in early podcasts, but this thing goes way beyond what I had to say. Mostly, I was just telling stories about how goofed up you can get in a boat when the anchor drags. So many folks end up damaging their boats or the boats of others because they just don't know about the things that Mark shares with us in this book. Now, there's more. Mark and his wife, Miriam, have spent a lot of time cruising in the Caribbean islands and around the coasts of Mexico and Central America. His Sea Runner 34 is probably the most highly developed for cruising Sea Runner ever. And his material is just loaded with eyewitness how-to information, plus a bunch of great stories about cruising in one of the world's best cruising grounds. Now, I'm giving him a plug here because this guy is the real thing. Now, you can find the links to his materials on the main page to this podcast and on the general products page for OutRigMedia.com. Help yourself. Yeah, the heck goes again. I have to keep restarting the machine, booting up all the programs again, and do without Zoom text. I've got to get some help with this. I may need a new machine. I don't know when I'll be back. I do want to continue with this. We're up to 3,600 listeners now. And if I can't work for the next week's podcast, I think Joe Farinaccio will send you an email, let you know what's going on. You folks have been very patient with me. Thank you so much. Hey, fair winds and bye-bye.